In these 3 weeks together, we're talking about the noble truths and how our understanding of them becomes more subtle. It changes over time. So today we're going to continue with the second noble truth of abandoning the arising of dukkha. So that is a simple statement of the second noble truth, is that there is that it's a tanha, which is translated as craving, but literally means thirst, is the condition that is present for during the arising of dukkha. It's always co-committant with it, if you will. So, and the task associated with that is that we want to abandon this tanha that leads to the arising of dukkha. Or we could say that we're abandoning the clinging or the craving. I think they're quite similar, that accompany dukkha. I'm a little bit cautious about using the sometimes standard translation that this is the cause of dukkha, because causation is a little bit different than conditioning. And so for precision, we could say that the craving and the clinging accompany the arising of dukkha. So a lot of Dharma practice is about this, right? It's about abandoning or letting go of various forms of craving and clinging that we have. These words sound kind of obscure. We don't use the word craving very often, or clinging, at least not in this sense. But it really encompasses, wanting, not wanting, irritation, hating, overexcitement, envy, jealousy, all the problems of the mind are some form of craving or clinging. And then there's also the ignorance that underlies all of that. So this is a skillful abandoning. When we say we want to abandon, that's usually the word used. Abandon the craving or the clinging. Sometimes people worry about the word abandon also, because we think of like abandoned children or something like that, and we don't want to abandon things. It's not like flaking out or ducking our responsibility. In this case, this is a skillful abandoning, kind of like we would abandon a non-functional car, or we would abandon an idea that didn't work out. We've worked on this idea for a long time, and I think we should just abandon it. That kind of thing. So in the Dharma, we practice to abandon what is bringing about trouble in our mind and heart. So we could also call it letting go. So the way that we deepen along this dimension of letting go, or understanding and letting go of craving and clinging, is that we slowly come to see what role our own mind is playing in the dukkha that we experience. And that makes it a lot easier to let go of what the part that we're contributing to the difficulties that we're having. And so our understanding refines over the course of our practice. So I want to talk about, again, this kind of process that we go through, and with the same caveat as last time, that it's not an exact order and your mind may do it slightly differently, but we're generally moving through different ways of understanding, abandoning the origination of suffering. So the first, where we start, is there is a skillful avoidance. You can just not encounter that which brings up craving or clinging or dukkha. It is actually skillful, skillful avoidance. Remember that right effort, one of the steps of the path, includes abandoning the dukkha that hasn't arisen yet. And that's skillful avoidance. You just don't do the things that you know are going to bring it about. So there are a lot of many examples of how we might practice this. If you're working to reduce your consumption of ice cream, don't have ice cream in the house. It's even that might be hard, right? Because you're in the store, there it is. But, or maybe your partner keeps it, but, it's a skillful avoidance. Or, maybe more gravely, alcoholics would definitely need to avoid going into bars. You just don't do that if that's if you're working on that. And we can also get out of relationships that are really toxic for us, or we can get out of unhealthy working situations. We don't have to just sit and sort of endure everything and just be mindful of everything that happens. We can skillfully change things so that we aren't in situations that are painful, that are bringing about dukkha. As a teacher, I often hear from people who have practiced for some time that they are starting to be less interested in hanging out with some of their friends, the ones that are not interested in ethics or practice or mindfulness at all, and are maybe sort of opposing those in their actions and ways of speaking, so that there's some discomfort and there's a process of skillfully reducing the amount of exposure to these other to these other people, let's say. So there are lots of ways that we do this. A good friend of mine went on retreat. Her first long retreat was the 3-month retreat at IMS, and she spent a lot of time in her room. She would come to the she practiced. She had a single room, and so she practiced in there. And then when it was mealtime, they usually have the food out for 30 minutes, and she would arrive 25 minutes after the food was out when everybody had already gotten their food and was sitting down. And she could arrive and just go through the line and then sit down. So she also even skipped some of the Dharma talks. And she said later, she told me that what she was doing was she felt just this feeling inside of her that she really wanted to protect her budding mindfulness. It was tender. It felt like she didn't want to disrupt it at all. So she didn't expose herself to anything that might be agitating. And, that was probably skillful on a long retreat. She was really quite dedicated to the practice. And it can be, there are areas where this is absolutely necessary, some of them I mentioned. But there are also areas where we avoid things for a while, but we can't keep it up for the long run, and it's not exactly the aim of Dharma practice that we box ourselves off from everything that is agitating us in certain ways. And so, of course, we need it's not a long-term strategy. We need other strategies also for not having dukkha arise or not having craving and clinging arise. So, if we can easily avoid things, okay, but it doesn't really get to the root. It's not going to get to the root of what we need to accomplish in our practice. So we then, that provides the some understanding that we'll need to do other things. And I'll maybe just mention one other area that's kind of this same ilk as avoiding, which is that there are some skillful reflective practices that we can do that reduce dukkha, or reduce the help us abandon craving and clinging. So one way is to set intentions before we do things or before we use things. Some of us have probably done this practice. So for example, we have the intention, I will enter the chocolate shop and only buy a gift for my friend, something like that. And we set that intention going in, and it can support us while we're doing the shopping. Or, I'm eating this meal to sustain my strength and not just because I'm bored or anxious, something like that. Or I intend not to get upset by the construction noises that are going on for the next 3 months next to my apartment building, things like that. So we have kind of little resolves like that. So this kind of conscious reflection is good. And it again, we can kind of prep our mind in this way. And we'll continue to use both reflection and avoidance over time, but there are other ways that can go deeper than these. So maybe you're not surprised to know that the other major area I want to talk about is mindfulness as a form of letting go. So we can also release craving and clinging through what could be called generally seeing, through various forms of seeing. So the issue with these is that we want the stimulus, we want what's coming in to be weaker than the strength of attention. So I sometimes demonstrate this visually where, you know, if our level of attention is to say here, some arbitrary amount that we can carry, and something comes in that's less than that, you know, it can happen and we can be mindful of it. But if something comes in that's really powerful, you know, our mindfulness is gone. And then sometime later, we wake up and realize that we weren't mindful. And it's because something came in that was stronger than our level of attention. But if we practice mindfulness, the strength of our attention goes up. And then the same thing that would have disrupted it before, we can be mindful of. We can probably all think of things where we weren't able to be mindful in a certain situation at the beginning of our practice. And then after some time, we realized, hey, wait a minute, I was just able to be with that and I didn't totally lose it. So that's kind of nice. Yeah, we can think of cases like this. For myself, I took a training in Buddhist chaplaincy. I did the Sati Center Buddhist Chaplaincy Program, which is a wonderful program, by the way. And when I started it, I was not at all confident that I could be a spiritual support person, which is what I was volunteering to do in a hospital. And, you know, I was supposed to go into a room where I didn't know anything about anything that was happening in that room particularly, but just offer myself and say, you know, I'm here as the spiritual support person. Would you like to talk? And, you know, maybe there's several people in the room and you don't know the relationship between them and you don't know what's going on. And I was pretty unsure how to do all of that. That's not very natural for me. And I didn't have earlier training in that. And so, but nonetheless, through the just practicing it, essentially, I got to the point where I had much more comfort with doing that. I was able to be more present. I had more options than I did at the beginning. At the beginning, I was kind of sticking to the script that I'd been told because I had to stay with that to be in a situation like that. But then, you know, it got to the point where I had a much stronger attention, much more confidence, and I had more options available. So you can probably think of examples like this also from your own practice. So mindfulness has this somewhat magical quality of starving unwholesome qualities, it's called, and nourishing wholesome ones. So when we observe anger, it will gradually decrease if we are watching it without attraction or aversion, which is not always easy with anger. We tend to either want it to be there or not want it to be there, and that interferes. But if we can be genuinely mindful of anger, it will decrease over time because it is starved by not having its basis. And then conversely, when we observe happiness or love or patience, it will tend to increase. Wholesome qualities tend to be nourished by genuine mindfulness. So that's sort of good news. That's kind of the basis of the practice, actually, is that it has this special quality that we can have confidence in. And then on top of all that, mindfulness itself will strengthen each time we use it successfully. So as my teacher once said, no moment of mindfulness is wasted. So if we were present for something, even though it didn't seem like anything much happened from that immediately, over time, one of the suttas says it's like drops filling a bucket. You don't think the bucket looks very full after five drops, but you know, if we just keep doing that for a long time, the bucket will fill. So no moment of mindfulness is wasted. Over time, this process can even, you know, break fetters in the mind. It can even, and those could be the official 10 fetters that we need to overcome for awakening, or just, you know, unwholesome states that are binding up the mind. There's a nice quote from the teachings about a ship, the ropes on a ship. So it says, suppose, this is the Buddha, suppose there was a seafaring ship bound together with ropes. For 6 months, they deteriorated in the water. Then, in the cold season, it was hauled up on dry land, where the ropes were further weathered by wind and sun. When the clouds soaked it with rain, the ropes would readily collapse and rot away. So there's the sense of in this analogy, I liken all of the weather forces to mindfulness. You know, it's the wind, it's the sun, it's the rain, just the way that we look at things, that we touch them, we observe them, we're with them, we be with them. All these different forms of mindfulness, each one, you can think of it like slowly rotting the ropes in your mind. And there will come a time when you pull on that rope, you know, the rope attempts to bind you and it just, you know, it can't, it just falls apart. So there are also some more specific ways that, you know, methods that of letting go through seeing that are talked about in the teaching. So one of them is that you may have heard is guarding the sense faculties. This is a common phrase that you'll hear. It's part of the gradual training. It's an aspect of mindfulness where we, you know, we particularly notice what is coming into the sense doors. That refers to the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And we notice that we notice whether or not what's coming in is being picked up. You know, does the mind look at something and it's able to say, okay, that's a table? Or does it say, oh, that's a table. That looks just like that table in my grandmother's house. Oh, I loved that table so much. And, you know, we go on. Or actually, you know, just a moment ago, my eye was caught because there was a beetle walking across the floor next to me. And, but I don't even see it anymore. Because I just looked at it and I looked back at the screen. There was no particular aversion or upset about this view. So, you know, you just watch the mind guarding the sense doors so we don't pick things up and make more of them than they are. There's also then another form of this is called enduring. And so that's the case where we can't do anything about a condition. And so we just mindfully let it be. And there are cases where that's just how it is. So if it's a very hot day and you are in a room that doesn't have air conditioning and you have to be there, well, you're just going to be hot. And so you have to endure that for a little while. Or there are times where we're on the way home for dinner, but we get stuck in traffic, or there's an accident and we're going to be an hour late, and we're just going to be hungry for an hour, and that's how it is. And there's really nothing that can be done. So there's the key here is to not have aversion to situations like that that we can't control. So it's not enduring, like, you know, gritting our teeth and surviving it somehow, but, you know, just bearing with it with mindfulness. And you know, this is a skill because there will come a time when, you know, we're in the process of dying, for example, and that's a good time to endure and just let be what the process that's happening. So we can practice on that with these inconvenient situations before that. I know for me, I've had a number of dental procedures in the last couple of years. It just happens to have been a time for that. And the one I seem to need most often takes about 2 hours to do. And it's, you know, it's not anything very bad. It's not painful because they use the anesthetic. But nonetheless, it's kind of an endurance to have my mouth open for that long and all this stuff. So, but it's not bad. I'm getting used to it. I don't have too many more teeth that they can do that too. So, you know, enduring is also a process of mindfulness. So the best observational tool for weakening attachments, also an aspect or a form of doing mindfulness, is to see arising and passing. You've probably heard of this. You know, this is bringing in the wisdom component, but it works slowly over time, even without consciously noticing it. We don't actually have to sit there and, you know every time that we're observing arising and passing. If we just make it a habit to kind of watch the way things change, the heart is learning at a deep level that things are coming and going repeatedly. It's kind of getting in there. There is an interesting exercise that you might want to try. Some of you have heard me describe this before, but it's a really great one. It's called riding out a desire. And that's a case where you notice that a desire has come into the mind for something that is doesn't really need to be fulfilled right away. Something like, you want a cup of tea while you're reading something. And it's not that you're really, really thirsty and just and have to drink something, but it would just be nice to have a cup of tea. And so you just say, well, wait a minute, this is going to be my opportunity to practice writing out a desire. And you just sit and wait, and you don't fulfill this wanting a cup of tea. And you don't have to sit there and pretend like it's an endurance contest. You just say, no, not right now. And you keep going on with what you're doing. And you notice the but you notice the desire, and it may get stronger at first because you want that, you really want that cup of tea, but you're saying, no, I'm not going to do that. So it gets stronger and stronger, and maybe you start to sweat a little bit, but eventually it will release, and your mind will decide that it's not worth it to keep gritting its teeth and complaining about having no tea. And so it'll just kind of fade, and you'll say, well, go on with the book. You'll realize you've gone back on with the book. But what you should notice at that point is that the desire went away without being fulfilled. Because this is what we've trained ourselves for a long time, is that we've trained ourselves that desires go away because they're fulfilled. We got the tea. Here it is, I got it. And sure enough, that desire goes away once I have the tea. But I didn't learn that desires go away even if they're not fulfilled. And that is a very important wisdom lesson to understand. So it's helpful to begin training yourself this way, because otherwise the mind has a story that the only way to have relief from what? Craving is to fulfill it. So we can abandon craving just by watching it, actually. And that teaches us something very important. So now we're shading really into wisdom practices. And this I want to is still mindfulness, but I'm going to call it wisdom. It's pretty much similar, but it's a sharpening of mindfulness practice into wisdom practice. The Buddha was very clear. He said explicitly, nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I or mine. Or sometimes just stated as nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. So in our practice, we can start to watch the mind's movements toward getting or having or becoming something. There are ways in which we lean in those directions. So now we're moving away from the objects of craving and clinging, which is kind of what I talked about first, to the mind that is craving or clinging. Do you see the difference? They're both going to be present when there's craving present, but we can turn and look at what these things are. What is obsession or craving or clinging or identification itself? What is that as a phenomenon? That's another thing that can be observed with mindfulness. So there's a wonderful simile, wonderful sutta, MN66, the simile of the quail, that has a lot of different teachings in it. But one teaching it has near the end is it discusses four different ways of relating to the mind that is grasping. So when the mind is grasping, how do we relate to that? When it has thoughts of attachment or hatred or fantasy or other things going on, how do you relate to the mind that's doing that? Never mind what the object is, that's not even important, but the mind that's doing that, how do we relate to that? So the Buddha talks about kind of a gradation of different things that happen in people's minds when there is grasping present. One is to tolerate that, so to go for it, that's right, I need to grasp onto this. This is pretty much just indulging in that. And so the person is fettered, according to the teachings. This person is fettered. So then the second level is to, it says that the person doesn't tolerate the grasping, but they have aversion to it, or they deny it, or they avoid it. Interesting, right? We had avoidance earlier, and there are skillful ways to do that. But it's also possible to kind of pretend that you're not grasping at something or be aversive to it. I know I've done that, is that I've seen my mind wanting something, and instead of, and I know I'm not supposed to want things, right? Want this particular thing. And so then I get irritated that I want it. Well, that's a second arrow, you know, that's not actually skillful. So the Buddha just says abruptly, you know, this person is also fettered, you know, the person who is averse to their grasping. So that's not going to work either. But, you know, we do that sometimes. So then the third kind of way that we might relate to a mind of grasping is to have mindfulness of our grasping thoughts. And the mindfulness of the thoughts might arise slowly, it might arise quickly. But as long as we have the mindfulness, as soon as it's there, the Buddha says that this person is practicing well. So mindfulness is the, you know, is the path to letting go of grasping. But while he is also clear that while the mind is grasping and we're being mindful of grasping happening, you know, say for example, when we're riding out a desire, we are being mindful of grasping. He says that person is still fettered. And we can understand that, you know, it's not that comfortable to have a mind that is grasping at a certain moment, or, you know, it's inverse, hating something or irritated or jealous or something. So that's not pleasant. We can see that the mind is not in a wholesome state, but we can have confidence based on this sutta that if we're mindful of that, it's okay. That's part of the path in that moment. So that's good to know. We are able to be, you know, fully mindful of unskillful states. And then the fourth one says, the fourth and final way that we can relate to a mind of grasping is that one says the mind divests itself of attachment, and this person is unfettered. So the mind just, you know, it sees the grasping arise, and the very act of seeing it dispels it. And it might be that you've had this experience. You know, you don't have, it's not only for, you know, the most advanced practitioners to be able to just see and obliterate grasping. Remember, I showed this example where if the object is not as strong as the attention that we have, it's possible that it will just arise and pass and not have any effect. It can be that while we're being mindful, we can watch something come in, like a thought that's not skillful, and before it even forms, it just bumps into our skillful attention and dissipates. I had an experience where I was with somebody who said something that was triggering for me, but I happened to be very mindful at that moment. I was in some conversation with them, and they said something that was irritating, and it might have been one of those things that I either reacted to in the moment or I stewed about for hours later. But it happened that I was so clear and mindful and wise at that moment that I literally experienced the anger that arose like a flash, like kind of a and it actually went out of me. You know, I felt it arise, and it didn't even stop at my skin, or it didn't get stuck in my belly or my throat. It just went, phew, you know, like a star ejecting a ring of matter or something like that. And it was gone. And I realized, yep, I was angry at that moment, but it was instantly gone. And the image given in the sutta is that you have a frying pan that's really hot, and you drop water on it, like, and it goes, psst, you know, it just sizzles away instantly. So this is a beautiful way that we might sometimes experience observing and abandoning the craving and clinging that would lead to dukkha. So that's it. These are various layers of understanding that we can have around how to abandon the arising of suffering, how to abandon the craving and clinging that underlie suffering. We have generally different kinds of mindfulness practice, but there's also things like skillful avoidance, skillful reflection, skillful endurance. They all kind of cluster around seeing clearly, seeing it all, and then seeing clearly. So the fourth noble truth applied to the second noble truth. As we walk the path, we have more and more of these different methods available to us, and we can observe them deepening in our own mind and heart over time. So what I would like is to have you guys discuss again in breakout groups just briefly, and then we'll have a chance after that for either sharing what you talked about in the breakout group or asking questions about this topic. The prompt will be to share an example of something that you used to have to avoid because you could not be mindful of it, but now you have enough strength of mindfulness that you can be present for it. Maybe a certain person or relationship or situation where it used to be that there was no way you could do that and still be mindful, and now you can, at least sometimes. And it doesn't have to be a long story. Instead, just focusing on what you couldn't do at first but now can, and maybe how that is for you to be mindful of it. What does that feel like? It's been wonderful this evening, and let's have a good week of practice, and I'll see you again next week. Be well.